Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Eastern Airlines Radio Show. There's breaking news. Dorothy?
Breaking news number one. American Airlines pilots say 10,000 flights, 30 million gallons of fuel later, pilot ends 33-year career with a final trip to Dallas by Dana Branham, Dallas News. A pilot ended his 33-year career with American Airlines when he touched down at DFW International Airport on Sunday. After 10,000 flights and 30 million gallons of jet fuel, Captain Jeff Rowland thanked his last round of passengers in a typed note. In the note, which Los Angeles Times reporter Sam Farmer shared on Twitter, Rowland reflected on a long career in the pilot seat. He said he certainly missed flying in the $200 million Boeing 787 plane, but it missed his passengers most, transporting you to destinations all over the world while you graciously endured my lame PAs, critiqued every single landing, and thanked me for safe flying, provided purpose for this lifelong endeavor, he wrote. See the story and comments on our website in the news blog.
Breaking news number two. Mexico may allow United States Air Marshals to use stun guns on flights. This is by Gabriel Stargardner by Reuters. Mexico is in talks with the United States on whether to allow U.S. federal air marshals to travel with taser stun guns on cross-border flights with U.S. airlines. That is what National Security Commissioner Renato Sales said in a TV interview last Tuesday. Commissioner Sales comments came the day after Reuters exclusively revealed that Mexico and the U.S. were looking into an agreement that could allow armed U.S. federal air marshals to be deployed on commercial cross-border flights. In his interview with broadcaster Televisa, Sales said no memorandum of understanding has yet been signed with the U.S. He added that talks to allow U.S. federal marshals in Mexico stretch back for years. See more in newsletters January to June 2018.
Breaking news number three. Report: airline safety record has been analyzed by Mary Grady. For the first time in aviation history, in 2017, not a single person died anywhere in the world because of a jetliner accident. One man did die in a crash in a Canadian ATR-42 turboprop in December. Chance of dying in an airline crash is now about 1 to 50 million, according to a recent analysis, Wall Street Journal. "It's just stunning," was a quote safety consultant William Voss told the Journal. Quote, "I hope that we can sustain, but that's just going to be too hard to do." Flawless safety record can be attributed to a lot of hard work by many people over many years, but luck also played a role. Several analysts noted that a few close calls last year, notably the Air Canada incident in San Francisco, could have dramatically changed the outcome. The analysis also said there have been substantial improvements in the development and the developing world, which has long trailed behind in the airline safety industry. You can see more of this in a newsletter, January to June 2018. Over to you, Chuck.
January 30, 2018. United Airlines employee at Newark Liberty International Airport in New Jersey recently told a passenger that her emotionally support peacock wouldn't be able to be accompany her on her flight. They must have really ticked her off. It may sound bizarre to bring a peacock on an airplane, but give the woman her credit for persistence. She reportedly tried several times to get the bird on board and even offered to pay a separate ticket for it. But the airline employees nixed every request. According to the travel blog, Live Let's Fly, the passenger identity was not released. This animal did not meet guidelines for the number of reasons, including its weight and size, United said in a statement to Fox News. See more newsletter, January-June 2018. Jim? I didn't hear Jim.
Okay. Give a little background music here, and we'll have Jim Hart with us, but he's not here. So, hello, Eastern family. It's great having you with us tonight. My name is Neil Holland, standing in for Jim Hart. Along with our other host, we want to welcome and thank you for listening and calling into the show. You have made us the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. We'd love to hear your comments and share your memories with radio listeners from around the world, because we have you. If you haven't called into the show, all you have to do is call 213-816-1611 and just say, hello, hi, hola, buenos dias, como esta, bonjour, to talk with us on the air, live. We can identify many countries in our Blog Talk Radio application, so we know that folks are listening to the Eastern Airlines radio show. Isn't it great that we can keep the Eastern legacy going out to not only the Eastern family, but to listeners from many different countries? That's what we try to do every week on the Eastern Airlines radio show. Want to join us by adding your voice to these broadcasts? We would certainly welcome you, our thanks. Also, to those who choose to listen by computer, just type in www.ealradioshow.com. It's very simple. Or either go to our provider. Our provider is blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. That's CAPTEDDIE. Should you, too, wish to talk on our live broadcast, feel free to use our call-in number, which I see our board is lit up tonight, and that number is 213-816-1611. At 7 p.m., just like every Monday evening, Eastern Time. Let me repeat that number again so you can write it down for your Monday night visits with us. It's 213-816-1611. Our lines are always open for calls, and if you choose not to participate and talk live with your host, we'd like to ask you please to mute your phone, as our producer board does not have the capability of filtering out background noises. Now, let's get this flight 351 in the air.
Eastern's got the right time and the right place.
need to give the historical background of our first person with Eastern, Eddie Rickenbacker, that we talk about tonight. Books have been written about this giant of industry and a legend to many, especially to the Eastern family. A letter by General Jimmy Doolittle sent to his family best sums up the thoughts of anyone knowing him. It reads, Edward Vernon Rickenbacker epitomizes those human attributes, those basic values that have been American great, that have made America great, and which, if we continue to follow them, will keep our beloved nation great. They are not necessarily in order. Courage. He received the Congressional Medal of Honor in World War I. This is the highest military honor for bravery that a grateful nation can bestow. But even more important, he had moral courage, confidence in his convictions, and the courage to live by them. Integrity. His word was as good as his bond. I have known him for over half a century, and I cannot conceive of his whopping a fact. With integrity, one is a whole man. Without it, he is not. Patriotism. He served his nation superbly in World War I. He was America's ace of aces with 26 victories in the sky. In World War II, he visited almost every theater of operations as a personal representative of President Roosevelt. He visited the 12th Air Force, which I commanded in Algeria, and was almost hit by a piece of flak. Intelligence. In addition to his formal education, he achieved wisdom, judgment, and common sense through observation and analysis, through a careful study of his fellow man and what motivated him. Ambition. He practiced and believed in the well-organized hard work. So did our forefathers. This is certainly one of the cornerstones of our national greatness. He rigorously disciplined himself. This is the best kind of discipline. A person who disciplines himself does not have to discipline imposed on him by others. Humanity. He believed he was his brother's keeper. He was interested in and cared for his fellow man. Spirituality. He believed implicitly in a divine creator. He was sure that a universe as vast and as orderly as ours, from the microism to the macroism, could not have just happened. It must be ruled by a divine purpose beyond the mind of man. He spent a long and fruitful life in the service of his deity, his country, and his fellow man. This is the highest duty of man on earth. He has earned his rest, and this is signed by General Jimmy Doolittle. Now, Jim Holder, how about starting with our list for tonight's show?
Thanks, Dorothy, and it was great pleasure that I tell you about perhaps our most famous flyer, Dick Merle, Captain Dick Merle. These days, it's a little hard to imagine the celebrity status once given to pilots, but for a generation prior to World War II, pioneer aviators were revered like astronauts were in the 1960s. While not as famous as Charles Lindbergh or Amelia Earhart, Henry Tyndale Dick Merle ranked as a world-famous pilot by the 1930s, most notable for the 1936 so-called transatlantic ping-pong ball flight in millionaire singer Harry Richmond's heavily modified BLT, which was christened Lady Peace. Interestingly enough, she crashed on the return journey due to Richmond accidentally dumping the fuel. Anyhow, Dick later completed the first commercial transatlantic flight with co-pilot 27-year-old Jack Lambry in history. They were flying a Lockheed Model 10E Electra, appropriately named the Daily Express, and were especially commissioned to shuttle back newsreel footage of the May 10, 1937 coronation of King George VI, which resulted in a one-shot movie contract with low-budget Monogram Pictures for Atlantic Flight was named up 1937. Most listeners will recall that King George VI abdicated the throne a few years later as he could not marry a divorcee and remain the King of England. Actually, she was divorced twice, as those who watch The Crown on Netflix know. But I digress. I'm sorry. Dick Merle had begun learning to fly while stationed in France in World War I, but returned home to work on the Illinois Central Railroad as a fireman. He began his aviation career in earnest when he bought a 90-horsepower Curtis JN4 Jenny for $600 at a war surplus sale in Columbus, Georgia. This was in 1920. Merrill spent most of the 1920s barnstorming at air shows and eventually became an airmail service pilot, becoming its highest paid pilot, earning $13,000 in 1930. That's 10 cents per air mile. He then signed on with the floundering Eastern Airlines after it was restructured under the control of Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, who heavily promoted Merrill as his star pilot. Unlike some of his peers, Merrill was no hot shot. He was a deliberate and very careful pilot, so well regarded that many celebrities, including his friend Walter Winchell and even General Eisenhower during his 1952 presidential campaign, specifically requested to fly with him. Merrill's calm skills were evident during a flight in 1948 when the propeller blade came off on an inboard engine of an Eastern Connie, tore through the fuselage at 10,000 feet. They were off the Florida coast, and it killed a steward instantly. Dick was credited for saving the lives of the 69 people on board. Outwardly humble and unassuming, Dick thoroughly enjoyed his celebrity status, and although a non-smoking teetotaler, he loved the nightlife and hobnobbed with both the famous and the infamous. If he had a vice, it was gambling. He habitually spent his high depression era income practically as fast as he earned it. He was habitually broke, and it took marriage to settle his financial irresponsibility. He married vivacious 22-year-old actress Toby Wing in 1938. Actually, he married her twice because her mother objected their original marriage in Tijuana, Mexico, and the couple officially, end quote, married later that June in the home of Sidney Shannon, who was an early E.L. backer and close personal friend up in Fredericksburg, Virginia. Toby left Hollywood and retired from acting in the late 1938 after a brief Broadway run in the Cole Porter musical Flop, You Never Know, that starred Clifton Webbs, Libby Holman, and Lupe Velez. Despite their 20-year age difference, they enjoyed a remarkable 44-year marriage. The couple settled in Miami with Dick assigned the Miami to New York run, with occasional flights down to South America. He was too old for a commission, but he did sign on as a civilian MTD pilot and flew the China-Burma hump in a C-47 Skytrains and C-46 Commandos during the war, conducting critical supply flights and survey missions. He returned to Eastern Airlines after the war and officially retired on October 3, 1961, after flying a DC-8 down from New York to Miami. He reputedly had the most air miles of any pilot in commercial aviation history and ranked as the second most senior pilot with the airline. Dick continued to fly in his 80s whenever the opportunity arose, accompanying his friend Arthur Godfrey on an around-the-world flight in 1966. He set a speed record at age 78 while delivering a Lockheed 1011 TriStar from California to Miami to average 710 miles per hour ground speed, and even once flew a SST Concorde, a supersonic transport Concorde. Clearly, though, he was not the pilot in command on these adventures, just too old. But virtually no civilian pilot in the history of aviation piloted such a wide range, vast range of aircraft. After Dick's death in 1982, Toby, his wife, spent the remainder of her life actively promoting her husband's rightful place in the annals of aviation history. I don't know which of these gentlemen was best known by Eastern folks, but we know that Dick Merrill was the first. Ken? Oh, Ken.
So, I'm sorry. I might be muted there. You guys can hear me now?
Okay, Ken, you're live.
Okay, thanks. You're good guys. Thanks. Yeah, that's right, Captain Jim. And you know what? He hung on to it for his entire career with Eastern Airlines. And just think how nice it might have been to only choose to fly one line every month. That's almost unheard of by today's standards, certainly. So, Gene Brown, Gene Brown was another one. He flew into history as Eastern Airlines' first pilot. And by the time he retired, get this, on the eve of his 60th birthday in 1964, the year I was born, he'd flown 33,000 hours in every kind of plane that Eastern used. I mean, that's amazing. Now, the first plane Mr. Brown ever saw was at a fair in 1911 in Macon, Georgia. The flying machine took off without him, but he was carried away with it. It was the only career I ever considered, he was heard by saying once many years later. Pitcairn Aviation built the mail wing and also got the first federal airmail contract. Now, on May 1st of 1928, Mr. Brown took up the first night flight mail bound for Spartanburg, South Carolina, and Richmond, Virginia. Well, night flights paid more. It was a risky job, even riskier at night, as you can imagine. With few navigation instruments, it was, well, flight by sight. Fortunately, many of those nights were severe clear. The only good thing, no really a lot of tall towers to run into. And pilots followed beacon lights on the ground, about somewhere about 10 miles apart. If the sky was cloudy, they flew as low as necessary just to simply see where they were going. Now, you survived and were a hero, or you survived and were a hero, or wound up in the hospital, or you died. It was as simple as that, he told the Miami Herald once, columnist Charles Whitted in 1985. Now, early in his career, he'd crashed three planes, a Jenny and two mail wings, with a single injury, a cut lip. Sounds more like a Jake LaMotta. I never lost a passenger or a sack of mail, he once boasted. Now, he stayed with the company until it merged into two other small aviation companies that eventually became Eastern Airlines in the mid-1930s, and he became the very first senior pilot. Now, Mr. Brown was a farm boy from Decatur, Georgia, learned to fly on his own and by working on other pilots' airplanes in exchange for lessons. That's how he got into the air. After high school, he learned to fly formally in the Army Air Corps Reserve. And from 1921 to 1925, he flew passengers as a freelance pilot, sometimes for just enough money to buy the fuel so he could simply stay in the air. Now, in those days, daring young fellows usually went barnstorming, you know, show-off stuff at fairs and exhibitions and things like that. Mr. Brown did that for a while with the Maple Cody Flying Circus in Georgia, probably something nobody's ever heard of. Now, he will always be known as Eastern Airlines' number one pilot. Now, Jim Hart, many of us know this world-famous air shuttle that they talk about. I believe this next Eastern employee was the mastermind behind it. True?
I'm going to ask George Jen to see if he can fill us in on Malcolm McIntyre. George,
sure,
you feel up to that?
Sure, no problem. I flew the shuttle quite a bit. And Malcolm Ames McIntyre was the person who created a new format for air travel with Eastern Airlines' popular shuttle service between New York, Boston, and Washington. Mr. McIntyre was Eastern Airlines' president and chief executive from 1959 until 1963. Before that, he served as Undersecretary of the Air Force from 1957 until 1959. He was also an executive at Martin Marietta Corporation from 1964 until 1972, and then practiced law until his retirement in 1987. His innovation of shuttle flights in 1961 featured low-cost fares, regular hourly flights, no frills like meals or beverages, and in the greatest departure from airline tradition, no reservations were required. Yet the seating was guaranteed, with extra aircraft supplied to carry added passengers, even if it meant rolling out a plane for a solitary customer, has happened more than a few times. And I can attest to that because I used to bid shuttle standby on the 727. Mr. McIntyre's concept of the shuttle service grew from his own frustrations as a frequent flyer. He was quoted as saying, I was always baffled that the airlines didn't cater to business people's needs more. For the shuttle service, Eastern activated an otherwise idle fleet of old-fashioned piston planes originally, whose slower speeds in the jet age were only a minor drawback concerning the short hops from New York to Boston and Washington. The shuttle service was scorned by some executives of competing airlines as an airborne cattle car, but the idea of cheap, dependable, no-hassle flights quickly caught on with multitudes of air commuters. Eastern initially charged $13 for flights between LaGuardia or Newark and Boston and $15 between LaGuardia or Newark and Washington. I don't know how many of our listeners recall, but you didn't even need to pay. You could pay on board the flights. From 1961 until 1963, Eastern shuttles carried 2.6 million passengers. In those 2 years, Eastern, which previously had a minor share of the business between the New York area and Washington, now had 70% of the business. In 1929, he graduated with honors from Yale University. He earned one law degree at Oxford University in England as a Rhodes Scholar and another from the Yale Law School. He started practicing law with the Manhattan firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. In 1941, he joined the U.S. Army Air Corps in the Air Transport Command and left the service in 1946 with the rank of full colonel. A specialist in corporate tax, labor, and aviation law, Mr. McIntyre became general counsel and vice president of American Airlines a short time later. He was recruited to Eastern by its major shareholder, Lawrence Rockefeller, who knew Mr. McIntyre through his business dealings. Don?
That's right, folks. Most of us were around when this Douglas Fairbanks looking fella came to Eastern. Yeah, we're talking about Floyd D. Hall. He was born on April 4th, 1916. He attended local public schools and in 1934 was accepted to the University of Colorado, where he initially studied pre-med. He obtained his Bachelor of Science degree in 1938 and soon afterwards joined the Army Air Corps to learn how to fly military aircraft. He completed a two-year training period in the summer of 1940 and immediately accepted a job offer from Transworld Airlines to fly professionally as a first officer. When the United States entered World War II, Hall was called back into the Air Corps. While in the service, he arose to the rank of lieutenant colonel before his discharge at the end of the war. He rejoined TWA in 1946, where he served for the next 10 years as a captain and pilot on cross-country flights. Hall was offered the opportunity of moving from cockpit to a management position in 1956 when he was named supervisor of flying at TWA in Chicago. He was promoted to assistant manager of flying at the TWA office in Detroit in 1957, and in October of that same year became general manager of United States operations. Hall was named to TWA's executive staff and later promoted to general manager of system flight operations in July of 1958. He was elected vice president in charge of flight operations in April of 1959, and 2 months later was advanced to vice president and general transportation manager. Hall was made a member of TWA's board of directors in April 1961 and senior vice president and system general manager in September of 1961. He was given major credit for improvements in TWA's physical management. He was made a member of TWA's board of directors in April 1961, and a senior vice president and general manager in September of 1961. Guy was on the fast track. The directors of Eastern Airlines offered Hall the post of president and chief executive officer in November of 1963. On December 16, 1963, Floyd D. Hall became president and chief executive officer of Eastern Airlines to succeed Malcolm A. McIntyre, a lawyer who had directed Eastern's affairs since 1959. Hall immediately began to concentrate on delivering top-quality service and upgrading Eastern shuttle flights, which was still operating at a loss. He insisted that Eastern trim the cost of all company operations without neglecting the passengers. He streamlined Eastern's aircraft, making improvements to the quality of variety of the menus and introduced free drinks in first-class flights. He also launched an aggressive marketing and advertising campaign to get a greater share of the market. Hall raised on-time performance ratings from the second poorest to the best in the industry and arranged flight patterns to get maximum utilization of the new equipment. By averaging more trips per day, the company rapidly raised its capital investment. Hall drew up a detailed plan for Eastern's future growth with provisions for a profit budget that he believed would boost employee morale and increase efficiency. Despite the innovations, Eastern's financial outlook remained bleak. In December 1964, 1 year after he became president, Hall reported that his airline, still in the red, and shareholders equally had to continue decline. One of Hall's main objectives in 1965 was to expand Eastern's route structure and radically change the profit picture. An average passenger trip on Eastern Airlines was more than 100 miles shorter than that of other airlines, and the average hop between cities was similarly shorter for Eastern rather than the rest of the industry. The need to satisfy customer demands for jet service forced Eastern to use equipment that was not economically feasible for short-haul flights. The tide turned for Eastern at the end of 1965 when the company showed a profit for the first time since 1959. In July of 1965, Eastern petitioned the Regulatory Agency Committee to become a trans-Pacific airline, providing nonstop service to Hawaii. Hall also requested a license to expand the service to New Zealand, Australia, and Hong Kong. In a major reorganization at Eastern in December 1967, Hall was elected chairman of the board and chief executive officer in charge of all long-range planning. In 1968 and 1969, Eastern failed to turn a profit. In 1970, Eastern was the only major airline to report an increase in flight traffic, including business routes as well as tourist flights. Floyd Hall resigned from Eastern Airlines in December of 1975. Now, Neil, I understand that you have a very close relationship with our next employee.
Yes, I do. He didn't have the name recognition of those that we have spoken about tonight, but it was a great pleasure that I tell you about one of my best friends and fellow Eastern great, Mr. John P. Engel. John said in a newspaper interview that he first became interested in aviation when he heard on the radio that Charles Lindbergh had made his historic 1927 flight across the Atlantic Ocean. He immediately went to the library and checked out a book on air transportation, aeronautics. That was a year after Eastern Airlines' predecessor company, Pitcairn Aviation, began flying the mail into and out of Jacksonville, Florida. In 1932, the height of the Depression, there were few to no jobs for aeronautical engineers, even though those with a degree in the field from Georgia Tech But Mr. Engel was hired by Eastern as an operations agent in Charleston, South Carolina, servicing mail and passenger planes at the airport. In his memoirs, Mr. Engel wrote, "The job often entailed running out into the grassy airfield at night, sticking red railroad flares into the ground to enable the pilots to find the landing path." He moved on at Eastern to the main sales, Miami main sales office, and then on to the home office in New York before returning to Jacksonville as an outside salesman. After 5 years of active duty with the Navy during World War II, Mr. Engel returned to Jacksonville as a district sales manager. He continued to lead Eastern's operations in Jacksonville during a time when he saw the airline become the second largest in the free world based on annual passenger carried. He retired in 1975. "Dad believed that knowing your job wasn't enough," said his son, John Rusty Engel III, a Tallahassee lawyer. "He impressed on us that you have to get along with the people you work with and with the people you meet, and he was a master at that." He was a native of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Mr. Engel moved to Jacksonville in 1921 when his father became president of the street railway system here in Jacksonville, the Jacksonville Traction Company. He was a first graduating class at Robert E. Lee High School. He was also a Boy Scout in Troop 7, earning an Eagle Scout rank, which, by the way, both of his sons earned that Eagle status as well. In retirement, Mr. Engel concentrated on researching and writing the area's history, particularly in the field of aviation. And in 1977, he wrote a book, Aviation's Earliest Years in Jacksonville, 1878 through 1935. John led a very busy civic life. He was a past president of Jacksonville Historic Society, past president of Rotary Club of Jacksonville, past president of Navy League, and on and on and on. John was Mr. Jacksonville and also recognized by all the citizens, most all of the citizens, especially the business folks of the Jacksonville community, as Mr. Eastern Airlines. Again, I had the pleasure of working with John in putting together a book of memories that were taken from the magazine from the Retired Eastern Pilots Association, Repartee. We had a lot of fun putting it together, trying to choose the right stories. And John even added, I think, one of the most interesting stories. And we've done it on the radio show here a couple of times. And it was about the passenger that leaped out of an Eastern airplane. A lot of folks don't know that we had our own D.B. Cooper. But John wrote a great story, and I decided that I would turn it into a little script. And by the way, we had our host, that did a great job in doing that story. And one of these days we may repeat that. I want to let you also know that John served in the Navy. He commanded a destroyer escort, the USS Manlove. DE-36 was its class, which was one of only a few destroyer escorts to have been credited with the sinking of a Japanese submarine in World War II. He retired from the Navy reserve in 1959 as a rear admiral. I really enjoyed knowing John, especially when he invited me to be his escort to the fleet briefings that was for admirals only here in Jacksonville. And I had the pleasure of accompanying him twice on the USS Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, and the room was completely full of Navy admirals, retired, of course. But what a pleasure it was to know this giant of a man. By the way, he also suggested the founding of the Florida Aviation Historical Society and the Hall of Fame that's down in Sun and Fun in Lakeland, Florida. So it was a great chance I had when I came to Jacksonville to meet John and be a good, very good friend for many years until he passed away at the age of 96. Chuck, we all know the success of our maintenance operations, and I believe one man set the standards for maintaining the aircraft. Can you tell us about this person?
Sure, Neil. On Wednesday, May 6, 1981, the Engine Service Center was dedicated to John C. Ray in tribute to the company's number one retired employee. Johnny, who was 86 years old at the dedication, is well known to all pilots who were the Eastern from his concept in 1952 when he retired as General Superintendent of Maintenance. Johnny started with Pecarin Aviation on June 21, 1925, and was the first employee hired by the predecessor company, which started on May 1, 1928 as a mail carrier. Present at the dedication were Gene Brown, the number one pilot hired by Pecarin, Dick Morrow, J.B. Armstrong, Jerry Wood, and Joe Pastrini. About six other ARRPA members, in addition, there were about 100 others, included mostly officers of the company. Johnny Ray almost personally kept the right engines on the mail wings in top condition, was in charge of the engine overhaul shop from its beginning until he retired. At the time of the ceremony, he was as spry as ever, visiting the Miami base every Wednesday, as he had been since 1952, to see how the airline was getting along. He was still chomping on that big old cigar stump. Reaper reported the following upon the news of his death. Johnny Ray, Mr. EAL Maintenance, was known worldwide for his mechanical genius, for fine-tuning aircraft engines, and beginning with a wooden experimental Navy aircraft in 1915. His career in aviation continued uninterrupted until his retirement from Eastern in 1950. He was a perfectionist. He readily identified from a distance by that Panama hat and cigar. His granddaughter said, even when the cigar wasn't there, there was a hole where it was supposed to be. Johnny Ray was the kind of guy who encouraged his constituents to be innovative. As a result, they made modifications, invention tools, which resulted in Eastern having the most dependable airplanes of all. In the early days, Monty Chumbly, which he took folks through the Eastern maintenance shop, said, just look at the weld on that fuel tank. It looked as though somebody had laid down a line of dimes. It was perfection, just as Johnny would have wanted it to be. Johnny was Eastern's number one mechanic. In 1948, he said, to me, it's always been a worthwhile part of my life that I've always been doing what I really like to do. I like a footnote here. I was a tech service supervisor in building, I believe, five, and I was down in the employees. They had a little employees place to eat down there, and I was down there on my break. And down the aisle came Johnny, and he saw me sitting there by myself, and he said, excuse me, can I sit with you? And I said, sure, go ahead. He says, my name is Johnny Ray. I said, yes, sir, I sure do. My name is Chuck Albright. He says, where you work? I says, I'm a technical supervisor in the engineering department. I come up from the ranks of being a mechanic, and then I got promoted into management. He says, well, that's great over there. I've been in the engineering department. They're really a bunch of guys that know what they're doing, and they seem to be able to help out the pilots when they really need some help getting the planes back on the ground. I said, yes, sir, that's one of our jobs. And we sat and talked for almost an hour before I realized I was getting a little late about my lunch hour and had to get back. But he was a great man to talk to. I just sat there in awe to watch this legend tell me about his life, and I was enthralled by all the things that this man had done. So, Linda, do you have a story of one of Eastern's finest?
Chuck, I do, but I just have to say that I've always thought of mechanics as doctors because they can hear something, they have to have an analysis of a problem, and they know the inner workings, and they're really super intelligent. I appreciate mechanics. They keep us safe. But I'm going to talk about Margie Boyle. Margie Boyle retired as a flight attendant for Eastern Airlines having never missed a flight in 44 years. She began in Atlanta February 14, 1944, thinking that if she had a year as an attendant, it would be a good, quote, finishing school. Her tenure ended with Boyle working 11,000 flights, serving 1.2 million meals, flying 22 million miles. She even kept her original uniform size. Her first flights were in 21-passenger DC-3s, non-pressurized cabins, no air conditioning, and often no heat. She said, quote, "I would give bald-headed men pillows so their heads wouldn't get too cold." A big reminder of Margie Boyle was when a picture of her flight attendant tag appeared on eBay. Margie took her first plane ride at the Vermilion County Fair when it was held at Fairmount, Illinois. She paid for that ride with money that had been awarded to her for writing a story for a column called Boys and Girls Section of the Commercial News newspaper. She was a young girl when she soared over the farm fields and villages of Vermilion County for the first time. And that's what Fairmount, Illinois was called. It was so small, it was called a village. Well, that flight made a lasting impression on her, and flying became Margie Boyle's life work. In 1939, she graduated from Fairmount High School and enrolled in the University of Illinois. She obtained a degree in communications from the university, and following her graduation, she began her career at Eastern Airlines in 1944. Eastern, founded in 1927, is still a young company, but Eastern was well on its way to becoming one of America's leading airlines. World War II was in its final year. Margie began her career as a flight attendant that year. The nation was on high alert for air raids, but there was no stifling security at airports as there is today. Passengers could arrive 5 minutes before boarding time and make their flights. Family and friends could walk to the loading ramp with the passengers and watch the plane take off. There had been one hijacking in the 20s, but those hijackers, it turned out, they only wanted to use the plane so they could throw out leaflets over their South American country. Nobody was harmed in that incident. When Boyle and the other young women became flight attendants, there were two rules they were expected to follow. Number one, they were not to marry. And number two, they were not to have children. They could also expect they're going to be moved to a desk job when they were about the age of 35. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 gave flight attendants the legal backing they needed to have these and similar antiquated rules changed. Margie Boyle's historic career as a flight attendant spanned the careers of 9 Eastern Airlines presidents, including that of Eddie Rickenbacker, the World War I air ace. He is credited with developing the airline into a world leader in passenger travel. Boyle and Rickenbacker became friends. She was assigned to the New York office of Eastern when presidential candidate Dwight D. Eisenhower requested an Eastern Airlines plane and a crew for his 1952 campaign. Rickenbacker is credited with placing Boyle on that crew. The same crew served on every campaign flight that followed. Rickenbacker also introduced Boyle to celebrity Arthur Godfrey. She appeared on his TV show 3 times. Margie Boyle flew for 44 and a half years, had perfect attendance during that time, a record that has not ever been equaled. She met world leaders, celebrities, during her career. In 1985, she was named Flight Attendant of the Year in a national contest. Her career at Eastern combined flying with publicity and promotional work. For her accomplishments, she was named to the Eastern Airlines Hall of Fame. Margie Boyle never married. She lived most of her life near Atlanta, Georgia. She died in that area at age 75. A friend noted she never owned a car. She often walked to work, but the veteran flight attendant who flew her first mile at Fairmount never forgot her route. She continued to own a home in her hometown and was a life member of the Fairmount Jamaica Historical Society. During her life, Margie added 22 million miles to those first few she flew as a girl at the county fair in Fairmount, Illinois. I just want to say I never got to fly with Margie, but I knew who she was. We knew each other in passing, and Aston flew with her. He had the most positive comments to make about she was professional, relational. But one day, Aston and I were together, and there was Margie, and we both could talk to her. And I'm telling you, she was almost old enough to be my mom, but she never got old. She must have had a youthful spirit. There was something about her that was energetic and relational, and she was curious. She was interested. She was alive. And I got to looking about Fairmount, Illinois, and I wish that I had known that Fairmount, Illinois, in the 2000-year census, had a population of 640 people, because I would have said, Margie, I'm from a little town of 3,000. You know, we should never regret, and nobody ever should say a one-horse town. Wherever you grow up, it's going to be great. You never know. You may be like Margie and meet presidents and celebrities and fly and meet all kinds of wonderful people and have a terrific life. The Eastern people we remember tonight, there are just a few who made the name Eastern Airlines the legendary carrier that it was and it is. And we plan to bring you more in coming episodes.
Thank you so much, guys and gals. Did a great job. I'd like to make a comment on one or two of these people that we talked about tonight, especially Margie. I think I just checked out as captain on the 727 and one of my first flights. So I recall a lady that was very, very senior. As I was told, she was number one on the seniority list, was Margie Ball, and she was on my flight as a senior flight attendant. And I'll never forget that. What a graceful woman she was at all times, very professional, always a smile on her face that I can recall. And I had her a couple of times on other flights later in my career, and she was a remarkable person. And it was great having people like Margie and Johnny Ray and Floyd Hall and Malcolm McIntyre and Dick Merrill and Gene Brown and those that John Engel that we talked about tonight. I might have left one out, but we've got many people like this that a lot of folks never hear about. We always hear about the celebrities with Eastern. And we kind of started that way tonight, but we're going to tell you a little bit more about other folks that had great careers with Eastern and great stories. And any comments from our host about any of these individuals, please start talking about them, please. I've got my board lit up tonight, so I'm going to open all of our microphones. I've got a few of them shut down, so if anyone would like to make a comment, just barge right in.
Well, I just want to say this. It's Ken Boring real quick. I'm absolutely honored. And the reason I say that is because as I look through this transcript and I listen to this history, and I'm a whopping 54 years of age. I'm the youngest of my parents, and you guys know my dad, Weldon Lee, that hired in 57. You know, yeah. A lot of the people mentioned on here well, everybody that's on this broadcast knows or knew these people, and they're iconic in history. So, again, it's an honor to be here and just to know you guys and hear you talk about them. I'm very moved.
I am too, Ken. Thank you for saying that.
You know, I think with all the folks on here that were so unique, I think it just goes to show you what the uniqueness of the airline itself was. It was a memorable place to work. I know I have a lot of good memories from there. You know, the last few years, of course, weren't too good for any of us. But as you go through this, you look at all the firsts, all the great individuals, all the great leaders from Floyd Hall down to McIntyre. I mean, I recall the shuttle on Easter weekend. The lines are outside the hangar, and people, college kids and other folks, just waiting to go. I mean, there was, you know, it was just another world, and it was really fantastic.
No matter where you go, people talk about Eastern when they know that you're from Eastern, and they'll tell you, oh, God, I used to travel on Eastern all the time, or my parents always took Eastern Airlines. So it's
right.
Something that nobody has ever forgotten.
Yep. I've got a couple of area codes here. I'd like to find out who might be at area code 253. I'm kind of suspicious it might be Carlene. Is that you, Carlene? No.
I think Carlene's in 777 school right now.
Okay, 253 is a Seattle number. That could be Jeff.
253 is Tacoma. Just real quick, I'm piping in because that's where that's where I used to live, Neil. So 253 is Tacoma, Washington. I know that. Seattle's usually 206, but that's
okay.
253. Maybe they're. I don't know if they can hear you or not, but yeah, 253 is Tacoma. I know that.
Okay, we have had one from Ontario. I'm not certain whether he's still on with us.
Hello.
Hello. Renee McKinnon. Hello.
Renee, how are things? Is it white up there?
White? We have to look up the top of it. Bad.
Recognize any names
that
we talked about?
I haven't said a lot lately on the shows, but you guys are doing a fantastic job producing a show like this. It is just incredible. I acknowledge every one of you and the time you spend doing it.
Well, Renee,
Neil
is the person who puts together the script for the show. So he
deserves
about 99.9% of the credit, believe me.
Believe me, George. Believe me, Renee. If it weren't for the folks that are the host of this show, I certainly wouldn't be here. I would not be doing this. And it's fun to do. It really is a fun job. And we've got some more fun shows coming up. I don't know whether you heard last week. We made an announcement that on Thursday, every other Thursday, because we have From the Eastern Files on Thursday,
mm-hmm.
every other Thursday. Well, those fill-in Thursdays that are not the other Thursday. It's Old Time Radio, OTR, I call it, Old Time Radio. And we've got some great episodes that will be coming up. And if you are our age, anywhere near our age, we've got the youngest, I think. Ken, you've identified yourself as probably the youngest listener we have. but Ken, I don't think you remember Terry and the Pilots and Smiling Jack, but you probably read the cartoons and all. But we're going to take some radio shows from those series and put them on the air, and it's going to be sponsored by the EAL radio show. And of course, sponsors like the Fullers, Linda and Eston, and a retired Eastern Pilots Association that sponsors our show. We're going to put that on, and we're happy to do so. This next show, and like I say, doing these shows, none of us get paid. We have almost enough sponsors to keep us going, and we always welcome any sponsor that would like to come aboard and say, here's a little small token, and I'll send you one of my little books. And I'll be happy to do so. I'm out right now. I've ordered a batch of new ones, so I'll be sending those out. But we'd be happy to.
Can I ask,
Linda, go ahead.
Renee, do you have an accent? It sounds like you have an interesting accent. Is that true?
I'm a Canadian.
Oh. Okay. Well,
I didn't think I had an accent, but
maybe. It sounds great.
You know,
I am true.
Renee, we used to fly into Ontario,
Yeah.
And when did we stop service there? What year did we stop service in Ontario?
The last flights would have been when Eastern went under, because we flew right to the end.
Okay.
Wow.
All right. And we never did serve Quebec, did we?
Yeah, you did. Actually, Montreal was an old colonial station that Eastern bought out, and then they picked up Ottawa, and then the last step was
Ottawa.
In 67, they picked up flights out of Toronto.
Okay.
So we had three cities up here.
Yeah, I remember flying in
Ottawa. YYZ.
Yep.
But Quebec City,
yeah.
We never flew into Quebec City.
No, we never got to Quebec City, no.
Okay. Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Rene sounds like a historian. He sounds like an Eastern historian. He remembers.
Yeah, well, I had a great life at Eastern, 22 years, and it hasn't gone yet. I keep lots of memories.
Now, what did you do with Eastern? What was your position? What was it?
I started at the ticket counter, and I got operations, and I was there for like 12 years. I met most of these pilots have been through Eastern Ops. If you remember Gate 21, I would have signed you guys off with dispatch releases and all sorts of stuff. And then I got into sales, went down to Miami, and specialized in the Eastern's Las Americas, the South and Central America routes. And then I ended up back here through the process, and Eastern went under. But it was a great life, really, really good.
Oh,
you know about 010 forms, don't you?
Right. Yeah, we had some really, really great times in Toronto, great flights and great situations. I told you before about Slim Cox. He was a wild guy.
Oh, my
hey,
God.
Jim Holder, I think you and I can do a show on Slim Cox.
Yes, Lord. Yes.
So, George, Cox, you probably have a few stories too.
No, I never flew with him. You know, of course, I heard the stories.
Yeah, well, Neil, you know, I was a second officer, a co-pilot rep down here in Atlanta. We always had Slim Cox make his report. He was a chairman of the Operation and Training Committee. And we always had him make his report the first thing after lunch, because people go out maybe a little tired, you know, the first day and all that. But when Slim Cox came in there, it was a comedy show.
I don't know anything about Slim Cox. I feel like I missed out.
Well, ask your husband, Eston Fuller. Ask Eston about Slim Cox, and he'll tell you a few stories.
All right.
I had a friend that was a FAA controller in Atlanta, and every time Slim Cox was flying somewhere, there was a red flag on their computer following him around. Because they never knew what was going to happen. They're going to be ready.
His favorite expression was, "Wear it like a bow tie, son. Wear it like a bow tie." meaning flare that airplane just like it was a Piper Cub. You know, pull it back. I don't care what Boeing says. Don't push it on, pull it back.
Yeah.
Well, he pulled it back too much one time on a 10-11, and they fired him off the 10-11, and he ended up flying 727 his last couple of years. Cost about $1 million to repair that airplane.
I wish we could get a few controllers to tell stories about Slim. Interesting that you brought it up, Renee.
Yeah. Well, there's one time flying into Montreal, I heard the story. I don't know what the weather was or what time of year, but he had some conversation with the control tower, and they wouldn't let him do what he wanted to, so he buzzed the tower. And then they banned him from Montreal.
If he had guns, he probably shot at him.
Right.
Oh, my gosh.
I guess he was red flagged in Canada, too, then.
Well, we're going to taper off here a little bit, and I want to play you this little sound clip that's going to give you a little teaser here about this coming Thursday, and you'll be surprised who the guests will be. We have a World War II ace, fighter ace, that will be interviewed on this particular show that will do. And here's a little sound clip from that show.
Presenting Hop Harrigan, America's ace of the airwaves.
CX-4 calling control tower. CX-4 calling control tower. Standing by. Okay, this is Hop Harrigan coming in. Yes, it's America's ace of the airwaves. Coming in for another transcribed episode in the adventures of Hop Harrigan.
You've got to be with us Thursday if you can't tune in at that time. Don't forget, it will be archived, and so it will be, I think, the first one, and we're going to title it Episode 1 of this EAL Old Time Radio, and hope to have a lot of fun with it. And then, of course, every other Thursday if, will be from the Eastern Files, which will be a lot of Eastern history. So it's a lot of fun to do this. Dorothy, what you got going on the website and new members?
Well, you got any? The first thing, yes, I do. I'm so happy to report. But the first, what I would like to do is to congratulate you and your wife, Peggy, on your 60th anniversary, which was on February 2nd, last Friday. And, of course, we didn't get to do that, so we definitely want to wish you both the happiest anniversary. Hope you had a great one.
Applause.
You know,
applause, please.
Yes, applause.
How can I help forget Groundhog's Day?
Well, at least it's
but
a great remember.
Guess what? My wife forgot it.
Did you?
So I'll never let her live that
see?
One down. She forgot.
Did you see your shadow?
What they used to do
is they look over back over a period of years, right, to see how many have forgotten and how many remembered.
Yeah, I got them marked down, yeah. But, you know, when I used to do the Repartee magazine of the Retired Eastern Pilots Association, which Jim Holder does wonderfully, he does a great job on that. And I used to really be impressed by these pilots and their wives, especially when they reached their 60th anniversary.
Wow.
And now here I am one. So,
well, that's a big step, and we congratulate the two of you for getting there. That's wonderful.
Thanks,
but,
Dorothy. Thanks, guys.
I want to mention we do have another sponsor in addition to Esten and Linda Fuller and Sharon Deskin and Mary Lee Block. We have another host who just joined as a sponsor, Shay Oakley, and we want to thank Shay very much for his contribution. Everyone that contributes and donates to us, we certainly appreciate it because that's what keeps this program on the air and our website going constantly. And believe me, with the expenses that have gone up every year, we certainly appreciate that. And we do have two new members, so we're now have gone from 972 to 974, and we're just hoping and wishing that we make our 1,000 membership goals that we would like to this year. And thank everyone for helping us get there, and to please keep it going, and remind your Eastern friends and friends of Eastern to please join us. We'd love to have them. We had Mark and we had Julio who joined us this week, so we're so thankful. And just all of these people are on the website, and anytime you want to take a look at them, they're in under members, and you can browse the list and see who was in there and who wasn't. We also had email letters that have come in, and I have posted certain letters on the website. So be sure to go there and take a look at them. We have them under comments. I have some people that are under from the past that have written on Facebook and have given us some information on their Eastern time, which we'd love to hear. And anyone that has anything like that, be sure to send it in to us at host@ealradio.show.com, and we'd be happy to post those as well. We have some upcoming shows that are coming up, and next week We're going to put on aircraft engine power through the years, and we can't wait to do that one. And then following that's going to be 10 most famous people in aviation. And we have another one that we're going to be scheduling. We have all of March practically filled in. We have Eastern Brats number 2 that's coming up. So those of you that are Eastern Brats or part of the Eastern family, get your children to come aboard and be with us, and that's going to be on March 5th. So please try to get in touch with your family and have them certainly join us to be on that program. We have a lot on the website that you folks really need to go in and take a look at. In addition to the breaking news that we announce each week and put in the news area, we have a lot of different history items that we have on there and different videos that we show. There's quite a number of videos on there that really are very interesting, and I'm sure that you'll enjoy them once you go in and take a look at them. And, of course, be sure to tune in for Neil's new program that he talked about tonight. We're kind of anxious to have that roll out on Hop Harrigan and his other Sky King and different areas that Neil has chosen to give to us every other Thursday in addition to his From the Eastern Files. So be sure to join us on that time at 3 p.m. on Thursday. Back to you, Neil.
Okay. A very good show tonight, guys. And let's land the airplane. Flight 351, you're cleared to land. How about it, Chuck? Would you take us out of here?
That would be just fine. Great landing, Captain Steve. Be sure to tune in again next Monday at 7 p.m. when Eastern Flight 352 will be taxiing from the gate with another adventure. This time we'll look at the evolution of modern-day air carrier engines. Right up my line there. That's our show for tonight. We thank all participants in tonight's broadcast. Had a great time. And with this, we take a line from the stories from Lake Wannabegon, where all the Eastern women are unequal, all the Eastern men are good-looking, and all the Eastern children and Eastern grandchildren are above average. Until then, we'll say, good night, Eastern family. We love
good night,
you.
Eastern.
Good night, Eastern.
Good night.
Good night.